Galen Hansen.
Just following up a little bit on that, in that respect, I wonder to what extent the board considered the interaction of this the concurring reviewer with the client itself. And this has come up from time to time. Do they have the same level of discussion access as the engagement partner? Do they meet as regularly? Do they meet in person? Do they call independently? To what level is that independence of the concurring reviewer? I've seen this done both ways, where the firm wants as much insulation and independence as possible of the reviewer, and others that say, well, if they know the client better, they'll understand where they're coming from and so forth. But to what extent was that considered?
We did have some discussions of that, particularly with respect to the for the engagement quality reviewer to maintain his or her objectivity. And one of the issues obviously has to do with when you do have some accounting and auditing issues or contentious issues that come up. But most importantly here is that the engagement team has identified the issue, they have gathered the evidence, and they've come to a conclusion. And at that time, then the engagement quality review would be appropriate for him or her to step in and take a look at it. But most importantly here is that the engagement quality reviewer cannot be a part of the initial process of gathering the facts and gathering the evidence. That's not their job. And they need to stay outside and look in when the issue has been, when the team has come to an initial conclusion, then it's appropriate for that person to come in and step in and take a look at it. So, you know, objectivity here is very important, because this person is not going to fill the shoes of the engagement partner. And so it was very important to the staff when we were developing and drafting the standard to make sure that this person stays outside and looks in and maintains that objectivity.
Galen, is just to kind of follow up, I'd be interested in if you have any observation, you know, experiences at your firm or other firms kind of regarding the engagement quality reviewers' communications with the client, or preparers have any observations on how things are handled, that experience, and how that's been helpful or not helpful.
I think some level of insular, or compartmentalization of that individual makes some sense to at least consider that, and we kind of do that within our firm. We don't want that individual calling the CFO and having these discussions independently. We think that should go through the engagement partner, except for when they're involved in, say, an audit committee meeting.
Thank you, Galen. Sam Ranzella?
Well, having listened to the better part of the last 20 minutes, just a couple of observations. One, I think it's important that we keep in mind the objective, and then I understand some think that the standard could be improved, and I don't know that I disagree with that, but the objective here is to improve audit quality and improve financial reporting. And having, I hear sort of a sentiment around turning the engagement quality control reviewer into another policeman, where statistics are kept on what they found, or communications made to the audit committee about where they overrode somebody. I don't think that's actually going to improve the situation. From the perspective that the engagement quality review is just one element of the firm's overall system of quality control, and there are plenty of policemen at the firms with respect to internal inspections and other parts of the quality control system where there is a vetting and a, quote, a second guessing of that engagement partner. And I think this role should be more in line with getting it right the first time, improving the quality of the audit, and that client's financial reporting and communication to investors. So I think it's a balancing act. I caution you against turning this role more into a policeman than will be appropriate.
Thank you, Sam. Any other comments on the engagement quality review process?
You know, I do want to follow up on, I guess, Sam and Galen's point. I do think you need to strike the right balance between objectivity and independence that you do already have in the standard. But to do engagement quality, to get it right the first time, as Sam just said, there does need to be a certain level of interaction to make sure that you have a deep enough understanding of what those critical decisions and issues are. And if you go too far away, as I think that was just suggested, perhaps you cannot get it right the first time, and that's the objective.
Thank you, Vin. Larry Salva?
Thanks. 2 points. I guess on the interaction with the concurring partner between the concurring partner and the client interaction, I think, you know, the firms may take different approaches and, you know, at times may have taken different approaches as to how much exposure concurring partners were given to clients. I think that can really be left up to them, you know, in terms of what works best. My current experience is that I do, with the firm that I'm working with now, there was a point in time that I knew the name of the concurring partner but had no interaction with the concurring partner at all. And more recently, I've had some interaction, but limited. And, you know, I don't think engagement quality has suffered in either of those cases. You know, it's an internal working for the firm in terms of what works best for them. The other point I'd make is in terms of communication with the audit committee, if that is considered by the board, I think it should stay out of this standard. There's a whole slew of things that should get communicated to audit committees, and I think about the audit committee communication that I have in terms of kind of a standard question from my audit committee chair is what close calls may have been debated within our disclosure committee, our internal management committee that discusses issues and resolution. And if the audit committee chair is so inclined to ask the engagement partner or the engagement team, were there issues that were resolved through involvement of the engagement quality reviewer that would have been resolved differently had that review not occurred, fine, let the audit committee chair, you know, be interested in that, or put that into the mix of all of the communications that the auditor should have with the audit committee. But I think it should stay out of the specific standard. It shouldn't be called out as a requirement here.
Okay. Thank you, Larry. Any other comments on this particular topic, on the engagement quality review process? Okay, let's turn to the next topic, the concurring approval of issuance. The original proposal provided that the reviewer must not provide concurring approval of issuance if he or she knows or should know, based upon the requirements of the standard, of certain engagement deficiencies. In response to concerns expressed by commenters, the board revised this provision so that it relies instead on the auditor's existing duty to exercise due professional care rather than using the phrase knows or should know based on the requirements of the standard. Like the formulation in the original proposal, the revised provision makes clear that a reviewer cannot evade responsibility because as a result of an inadequate review, he or she did not discover a problem that a reasonably careful and diligent review a review form with due professional care would have revealed. For our discussion this morning, let's discuss the questions from the release that addressed concurring approval of issuance. In front of you on the screen is the standard for the engagement quality reviewer's concurring approval of issuance appropriately described in the reproposed standard. Is the first condition appropriately tailored to reflect the difference in scope between an audit and an interim review? Jim Snur.
Thank you. We view the removal of no and should no as a positive step, but are a little bit confused by the fact that in the discussion in the forepart of the standard, they define due professional care as the same as no or should no. So it seemed to me that, you know, while in one instance they changed the language, they made it clear that they thought the standard was still the same, and I don't think that addresses the concerns that we and others have expressed around that. The second point I would make is it seems odd to me that a individual auditing standard would specifically point out a requirement for due professional care when there is an overall standard, auditing standard, that deals with due professional care, which applies to all standards. And so it seems very odd to me that we would have a separate standard, which is then, if you want to call it, somewhat defined in the forepart of the standard.
Other comments? Gary?
Picking up where Jim was just talking, looking at the way at least I read, whether it's auditing releases or accounting standards, you know, there's the standard. Then there's the backup material, in this case, the release, you know, the basis of conclusions and FASBs. And, you know, so usually the standards are pretty clear in what they say, accounting or auditing or whatever. Then you go, what do you mean? And you tend to go to the releases and the issuing cover memos and stuff. And you where you get a little bit more free form in the words. And, I mean, I found, you know, over 25 years or so, is those are often more useful in terms of communicating intent than the final standard itself. So I can empathize where what Jim is saying with, and, you know, as a preparer, it doesn't matter all that much to me. You know, the preparers, I think, when they commented, worried about does this become a second audit, I think you're trying to address that. But I can see where they would read that there's a conflict between the release and the standard. Maybe we're reading it wrong. Maybe it's unintentional. Maybe it's just a draft choice of words and drafting. But seriously, the covering documents, basic conclusion stuff, get read very heavily, you know, in any assessment or interpretation of standards.
Other comments on concurring approval of issuance? Okay.
Greg, I think it's a great idea. I think it should happen. So, you know.
So you're supportive of it? This is an area we did receive a lot of comments. So interested in, you know, in views and in what we've done. So Galen, I thought I heard you say.
Yeah, I mean, I think it all ties back into the timeliness that we've had a prior discussion about, whether they're involved or whether this review is taking some, is being wrapped up, and there's points that are open after the filing's been made. I just can't imagine that there wouldn't be some level of formal sign-off on the concurring review, and after the fact doesn't do anybody any good. So, unless you're talking about next year's audit, Jim.
Ben Coleman.
Yeah, I just wanted to reiterate, and, you know, you don't want to repeat, but I also don't want the silence in this room to make the point that Jim and Gary have just made, that it's not a significant point. I mean, I think that the standard from a year ago has been significantly improved, as Randy said, and really appreciate that. But by far, this was the biggest issue with respect to the known or should have known. And it seems it's been taken out of the standard, but yet used as a synonym to due professional care. There is another standard that's out there on due professional care. I think we know what it is. And then to have something in there that basically, call it, almost redefines due professional care to be known or should have known, I really question whether or not you addressed the issue. And it's now done in a way, as Gary pointed out, it's in the back somewhere. I'm not sure it was a drafting error. Is that what we are saying or not? And I'm a little bit concerned, did we address it or not? I think we all felt like we did, but yet when you really read it, the answer is maybe we didn't. And I think it does need to be addressed, as was discussed many, many times, with the unintended consequences if you were to go in that direction. There's a real concern around it.
You've been. Doug Anderson?
And not to pile on, but just to emphasize a part that I was trying to make earlier, this whole issue of known or should have known, when you marry that together with the objective that's very broad, I don't know how it's possible to accomplish that objective, especially the standard of known or should have known, based on what it says in paragraph 9. And I get back to that, so I think the standard is inconsistent. It holds the auditor to a high level of performance, but then says you're only supposed to do that with these limited steps. And I worry that the objective and the expectation far exceeds what we're saying they're supposed to do. And that's the primary conflict I see in the standard. You put the external auditor in a very difficult situation of holding them to a high result, but saying they have to get there by doing limited procedures. And if that comes to fore, I think the objective will win out over what paragraph 9 says.
Other comments before we leave this area? Any other comments?
Well,
Greg, Paul Biswick, SEC.
Greg, I think it would be helpful if the staff did provide some views to the questions that Vin and Jim and others have raised. Is through the release, have you redefined due professional care, or are we relying on the existing standard? And it seems to be a question that was posed, and I think it would be helpful to people who are providing comments if there is some clarification provided.
Any other comments? Okay, let's move to the last topic for a discussion with respect to engagement quality review. Let's talk about the documentation I alluded to earlier. Under the new proposal, documentation of the engagement quality review should contain sufficient information to identify who performed the review, the documents reviewed, and significant discussions held during the review and the date that the reviewer provided concurring approval of issuance. If the reviewer did not provide concurring approval of issuance, the proposal would require documentation of the reviewer's reasons for not providing concurring approval of issuance. Final question then states, are the documentation requirements in the reproposed standard appropriate? If not, how should they be changed? Galen Hansen.
Paragraph 19 says, if no concurring approval of issuance is provided, the reasons for not providing the approval need to be documented. And maybe you can help me out with this, but if the review is required in order to be issued in accordance with paragraphs 12 and 13, I don't know. It seems contradictory. How can you issue the financial statements without the review, but if you don't have the review, you have to document why you didn't have the review? It just seems a little bit strange.
You're correct. I mean, obviously, Galen, that if there is no concurring approval of issuance, then the firm cannot issue the report. You're right. We thought you should, you know, just close the gap and explain what happened. And the work papers can be, because the report may never be issued, and the work papers can be archived, you know, as is. Okay, but you know, then you complete the. There may have been some discussions. I'm sure there were a lot of discussions, but the concurring partner or the engagement quality reviewer can close the gap, can close down what he or she was responsible for. Here's what happened, and then they're finished. They're complete. But you're right. You're right. There is obviously not going to be a report issued until there is a engagement quality review performed, and they concur. Jim Snur.
In looking at the documentation in 19C, which requires the reviewer to document discussions with the engagement team, significant discussions, going back to some of the comments we had earlier about Ben's comments around the process or the interaction between the reviewer and the engagement team, I don't see how, and Sam's comments earlier about what the objective is here, I don't see how the documentation improves audit quality. The engagement team has already documented in their in the work papers their conclusions about whatever the particular either financial reporting or auditing issue was. So I see this looks more like, as Sam talked, that police, you know, a cop coming in and having to document the discussions. It doesn't seem to add to audit quality, and it seems to be, I'm not sure what the purpose of it is. It's not really described as to what the purpose of that is. So I don't see any incremental benefit, and it would add a lot of potentially add a lot of time to the process.
Jim, on the looking at it from perspective of let's look at the engagement team first. But doesn't documentation audit documentation drive good audit quality?
I agree with that, but the engagement team under the auditing standards already has a requirement to document their significant conclusions. And what we're asking the reviewer to do is simply concur on those conclusions. So I don't know why the reviewer would then have to document in the detail that seems to be here that their discussions with the engagement team. I mean, there's already the overall requirement that, you know, that in terms of issuing the report, he essentially or she has to be comfortable with those conclusions before they give their approval. So an incremental documentation around, and given the number of discussions that potentially are held, I mean, if you think of a large multinational engagement, concurrent reviewer may spend hundreds of hours on that engagement. If they have to document, you know, every time they have a conversation around a significant judgment, it's unwieldy, and I don't see the benefit to the overall audit quality.
Sam Renzilla.
I'm not going to read. I totally agree with Jim. And the only point that I will add is looking at the purpose of that. What I might envision to be the purpose of adding that requirement, based on the proposing release, that requirement almost looks to me like an inspection. That requirement is focused on your inspection process, and I can appreciate that. But again, I would caution the board on writing auditing standards in order to improve their ability to inspect auditors.
Thank you, Sam. Joe Carcello.
Greg, if you forgive me, I want to go back and revisit the last discussion briefly. I'm sorry I didn't comment on it, but I needed a little bit of time to formulate my thoughts. My friends in the profession express a lot of concern about this due care issue and as it ties into know or should have known. And so maybe there's an issue there that I don't fully understand, and if there is, I'd like them to articulate it. But I guess from an investor perspective, to me, the way that standard, the proposed standard is written, is essentially it says if you review the documentation that the standard requires you to review, if you have the discussions that the standard requires you to have, using due care, which includes professional skepticism, then if there is a problem that's obvious from doing that, you either know it, but you can't know someone's state of mind, or you should have known it, which is allows for the fact that you can't know someone's state of mind. And I'll give an example of why I think this is important. I've done some expert witness work for the Securities and Exchange Commission, and in one of the cases I did, They were seriously thinking about bringing an enforcement action against the second partner, and they decided not to bring the enforcement action because the existing standard was sufficiently vague that they felt that they didn't have a strong enough legal basis to bring that action. But I would give you a concrete example. Let's assume I'm the second partner on an engagement, and in the work papers, inventory obsolescence is an issue. And so I look at the documentation, and the documentation is a client schedule of a high and low estimate of the obsolescence reserve that is X'd through with no explanation, substituted with another client schedule with a high and low estimate, which are much lower numbers than on the first schedule, and the number that's picked and that ends up in the 10K is the low number, which is the same number that was in the 10K in the previous year, where inventory had increased by a factor of 3 or 4 or 5 and had with indication that inventory was not turning over at all. To me, that would indicate that if I'm the second partner and the audit procedures that had been done were minimal, at least in terms of documentation of those audit procedures, to me that would indicate that I know, or if I didn't know, I should have known that I probably don't have sufficient appropriate audit evidence as it relates to the inventory obsolescence reserve. Because if I had used due care with professional skepticism, I would be troubled by that. So maybe there's a legal issue that the people in the firms can explain to me. But short of that, it seems to me that the PCAOB's language here is completely appropriate.
Thank you, Joe. Doug Anderson?
To go back to the other topic on documentation, I tend to agree with Jim that I see 19C as unnecessary. If you've got the paragraph 16 and you've got the recurring partner completing 19A, B, and D, I don't know what 19C adds.
Jeff Mahoney?
Thank you. I'm certainly not in support of unwieldy, unnecessary documentation, but you said to me a few minutes earlier that your inspection results revealed a lack of documentation so that you're unable to determine what the reviewer actually did. So I would err on the side of having more documentation, not less.
Thank you, Jeff. Hal Schroeder?
I would agree and take the opposite side of Doug. It's been a few years since I've done an audit, but when we had a concurring partner involved, we always, the audit team would write up that discussion and what the conclusions were. So all the independent partner or engagement reviewer, whatever we're calling it today, it would come in and sign off on that memo. So it would be not a tremendous burden, but went a long way in documenting what was actually done in the consultations, and that would include national office, which we haven't really touched on here. I guess that's in other people that you consult with. But I would strongly encourage you to leave C in there. I think it's highly appropriate.
Okay. Thank you, Hal. Larry Salva?
I agree that something should be included in the standard about documentation of the areas reviewed by the engagement quality reviewer, but I think 19C is too prescriptive, especially in large and complex and multinational engagements, et cetera, to say that the date of each discussion, the substance of the discussion, et cetera, it would become way too burdensome on the process, and I believe would add a lot of time without significantly enhancing quality. But I can appreciate that something should be written similar to like what Hal just suggested, a memo or something that indicates the areas that were reviewed would be appropriate, but to be this detailed I think is overly prescriptive.
Randy Fletcher?
I just want to respond to Joe Carcello's observation, and I am smart enough to realize with Professor Cox and a bunch of other attorneys in the room, I'm not going to try to articulate a difference between known and should have known and due professional care. I think Jim Schnur made a very valid point that due professional care is already defined for all audit engagements for all roles and seems redundant. Having said that, Joe, we have no objection to performing the engagement quality review in accordance with due professional care. So if it needs to be in there to reinforce, no one is really fighting that. What I think you're hearing the objection to, and I think it was laid out fairly clearly in comment letters on the original exposure, was that should know or should have known is a different standard and does have a legal connotation that we thought was not the right objective or the right standard. And so to see the board say, okay, we agree, we're going to change it and go to due professional care, which is well understood, but in the release still say, but we really think it's the same thing. It's that part of it, Joe, that we're saying we don't think it is the same thing. And whether we have legal opinions on that in our comment letters, that's the only issue I think that's really on the table is we don't think it's the same thing. And I'm not going to be, like I said, I'm too smart to take on exactly what those differences are. But that's all we're really talking about, not that we don't want to do the engagement quality review in accordance with due professional care.
Steve Rafferty.
I'm going to switch back to this 19C issue and sort of pile on with the auditors here. I think this could be terribly cumbersome, and I suspect maybe this came from the issue that you couldn't tell where the concurring reviewers had been in the files. But I really believe 19B probably accomplishes the objective in saying the documents reviewed by the engagement quality reviewer. You have to identify where they've been in the file. And I think requiring them to then document every discussion that they have on significant issues is going to be terribly cumbersome. A lot of those significant issues are going to be in the form of consultations that are documented in terms of what the issue is, what the applicable standards are, what the firm's evaluation of that is, and it's going to be signed off by that concurring reviewer, so it's going to be pretty obvious where they've been in the file and where they've spent their time. To then take and write a second memo that says, oh, by the way, I did also discuss this with the engagement team, it seems a little overboard to me.
Thank you, Steve. Ben Coleman?
Perhaps 2 points. Just one final point on in response to Joe's question by Randy. I think that I think Paul Beswick was kind of asking the question, is this a standard of performance or a standard of enforcement? And I think we're getting it confused, and I'd sure like to understand that, because I think that's where you just went, Joe. And I think we got to, you know, if we're going to talk about it, I mean, candidly, that's kind of where you'd have to go, right? Because we all know what due professional care is. We want to exhibit due professional care. So I think there's no debate around that. But when you start redefining what due professional care is, as Jim said, when there's a whole standard there, and then in a couple words redefine it for enforcement reasons, I think it starts getting confused. These are supposed to be standards of performance. Enforcement, let's decide how you handle that in a different manner, at least as it relates to how we would have people action a standard in our firm. And then moving to 19C, again, just being somebody in the room who is a concurring partner on a very, very large organization, when it says including the date of each discussion, I would just ask that you think through these words, and if you've ever kind of tested it in a real-life engagement, I think that you would see the cost-benefit would be incredibly difficult if you really understand the number of interactions that go on, you know, during the course of a year, if you're satisfying all the other paragraphs of this standard.
Wayne Collins.
On that 19C, it looks like it's almost combining a couple of things. I can see having that standard, and there is a standard in there already for consultations during an engagement where you consult with somebody in the National Accounting Department or whatever it happens to be, and you have a significant issue that you consult on, you document that. That's fine. These kinds of discussions that happen on an engagement are at various levels, various gradations, from the a very insignificant issue to very significant issues. And the ultimate resolution of those discussions are hopefully embedded in the work papers, and the work papers should indicate whether the concurring reviewer, engagement quality reviewer, reviewed those work papers. So I think that that ultimate resolution is already in the other parts of 19, and you don't need 19C for that reason.
Thank you, Wayne. Sharon Feierstein.
Wayne, I actually have to disagree with you. I think that actually if you just look at 19A, B, and D, it doesn't really get the whole flavor of what was done in that concurring review process. And while I agree that 19C is certainly overly prescriptive and there really won't be enough of a cost-benefit there, I mean, it's just the benefit will clearly not outweigh the cost of it. I think that there does need to be some type of summary describing what has gone on during that process, because frankly, telling me who did it and when they did it isn't really enough to tell me what was really happening in that process.
Galen Hansen? Galen? House Schroeder? Sorry.
I do see a definite difference between B and C. You can look at whole sections of an audit that have no major issues, but you still thought appropriate as a concurring partner to sign off on those documents or at least gain an understanding. And I've heard a couple times, well, that would be two memos in the file on an issue, and I would think that there would only be the one that the team wrote that talks about how the engagement or the concurring partner was involved in that process. And I'm still focusing on the word significant. I would assume that, and I've heard several people, well, they have to document every discussion. I think we're carrying it too far. It would be only those things that are significant. The team would document, and then the concurring partner's responsibility to go and sign off on those memos. Presumably, they'd be in some order for it to be not in a very burdensome process. So I see B and C as different things, and I think it's the only way to close the loop and finalize what actually happened on the engagement.
Jim Cox?
Yeah, I sort of feel the same way, Harold, that I think the point, and it may not be adequately well, I mean, it may not be well expressed in 19C, but I think the point is to communicate the level of intensity of the review that was carried out, quality review. And that is best communicated, I think, by identifying the areas where there was some evidence of drilling down. You know, we can think about this lots of other ways of handling it, that we all live by time logs, even academics, by the way. And so we may want to keep track of that and know that you've allocated a significant amount of time to a particular engagement and a particular inquiry. But I think the key point here is significant, and perhaps you'd like to flesh it out, but I think what the real issue here is so that if a third party, such as the PCAOB, comes in and reviews the quality of the quality reviews, they have some evidence of the intensity of the review that occurred. And if you don't have that, then I don't think 19A, B, and D get you there.
Thank you, Jim. Any other comments on documentation or any other part? Jamie Miller?
I just want to comment on this one as well. You know, I agree with the overall objective of requiring documentation for the review and that, you know, covering both the significant matters discussed and the nature of the documents reviewed. But, you know, I have to say from a cost-benefit perspective, I completely agree with the discussion we've had. I think, you know, as a practical matter, when you are dealing with very, very large engagements where the review can take hundreds, sometimes even thousands of hours, I think the level of the prescriptive words you have here may not be practicable. And so what I hear today is nobody's disagreeing with the intent of what's being written. It's the way it's written and the actual specific requirement that's articulated in C. So maybe that could be shortened and moved to a more objectives-based language.
Jim Cox?
Yeah, I think that may be the wording suggestion, is that you want to avoid sort of ironclad wording, but you'd like to communicate again what your objective is, and you'd like to have sufficient records or documentation so that should there ever be a third-party review, that one can make a judgment or the records are adequate to feel comfortable with the level of intensity that was appropriate given the challenges of the review.
Any more comments on documentation or any other aspect of the engagement quality review that we've discussed today? Gary? Yes.
I have one on a subject we haven't discussed if you're moving to a general discussion. I'm actually up on question one where you're talking about the types of engagements. You got an audit and you got the interim reviews, and it's a general statement, I would agree. Those are the ones you need to do, and a lot of other, you know, agreed upon procedures or long-form report for some due diligence. Those aren't necessary. But did you consider requiring any engagement quality review for SAS 70 reports being out there? I'm thinking particularly SAS 70 Type 2, thinking for our own, you know, SOX procedures. I mean, there's a lot of stuff is outsourced to vendors and information providers and so on. And that's sort of the where the world is going these days, more and more outsourcing, more and more offshore soaring to specialists. So I found over the 5 years we've been doing the 404 work, we actually have more SAS 70 reports now than we did in year one, because it's just normal evolution of the business. The question is, should you require an engagement quality review for a SAS 70 report that you're issuing? Did you consider it? My instincts tell me it's probably a good thing. I don't know if it's a great thing, and I don't even know if I'd hold up finalizing this and deal it separately, but was it considered, and listen for reaction to anybody else?
We certainly would appreciate your comments, Gary, and any others that any type of report that we should consider that should be subject to an engagement quality review, and we would like to have that in a comment letter. And if there's anything else, Gary, or anyone else, any other item that we should consider, including, please let us know. Let us know now or in a comment letter. Let us know if there's anything else we should consider. Yes, Galen Hansen.
I happen to agree that the SAS 70 and you can't really rely on a Type 1, but a Type 2. We're seeing more and more of those in practice, and the reliance on those are significantly increasing in quantity and volume. So reliance on information service providers, I think, is going to be part of where this profession is going. And I would look forward rather than go through this standard and leave it out, but maybe consider pulling that into the standard.
Thank you, Galen. Any other comments? Okay. Well, I thank you for your input, and I want to remind you that the comment period ends on April 20th. And I encourage you to write comment letters. Anything you mentioned today or anything you want to comment on in the release, I encourage you to get those letters into us. As you can see, you can see from this reproposal the impact that those comment letters had on the staff and the board, and we certainly appreciate your input. And I'll turn the meeting over to Jennifer Wren.
Thanks, Greg, and thanks again for your input in connection with that discussion. We're a little bit ahead of schedule, which in my view is absolutely fine. So we'll just go ahead and move to break. We'll take a 30-minute break as we had planned, but we'll adjourn at 10:45.